Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for coming this afternoon. And I'm delighted to be able to welcome you on behalf of the Development Studies Institute and the LSE Urban Research Centre to the seminar today. I'm going to introduce you now to Andy Pratt, who is director of the LSE Research Centre. He is located in the Geography Department, and he's going to chair the session this afternoon, and he will introduce our very distinguished speaker. So I hand over to Andy, and welcome.
Thanks, Jo. Well, welcome, everybody. In a sense, this is one of the first events that we've coordinated under the Research Centre. And as you'll realise, LSE has been carrying out urban research for an awful long time. But this is our way of probably trying to get our message over more clearly to the rest of the world that this is what we do. And also to speak more internally, I think, about some of the things we do. As in all organisations, it's very easy to disappear into your own office and only talk to your immediate colleagues, let alone communicating with the rest of the institution. And we have an enormous resource here, so hopefully this will be the start of many more events that are based on networking as much as anything else, as well as developing novel research linkages. And you'll hear more about that in the future. So it's very good that Joe from the Development Studies Institute has made this overture and linkage so we can host this event together. And we are truly very lucky with the event today that Franny is going to talk to us about many of the key issues underlying policy and policy development implementation for urban management in cities at this time. We're also extremely fortunate that the book that this is linked to, Cities in the Globalising World, is actually being launched officially here, I think. So we have a double first there. Let me just say something about Franny Lhotyer, that she's Vice President of the World Bank Institute, and that's the learning arm of the World Bank. And she's a recognised and leading expert in infrastructure strategy formation in developing countries. She's had several positions in the World Bank Group, including transport economist in the Latin American and Caribbean and South Asia regions, and as a research economist in the Development Economics Department of the World Bank Group. She served as senior sector director of the infrastructure in South Asia from 1997 to 2000, and held a position as director for the infrastructure group, which comprised of the merged practices of transport, water and sanitation, urban development and energy. So she seems in a fantastic position to be able to actually sort of give us an overview of some of the issues based upon on the research that has been going on, that she's been initiating within the Institute over the past few years. And I think this is a great opportunity to hear more about that, and also then to think about the implications for such findings for urban management, which I think she's going to give us some interesting pointers too. So without more further ado, let me give you the floor, and then afterwards we'll take some questions. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Anne. Good afternoon. I'm going to be standing here because I'll be using visual aids. So if you have trouble seeing me, I probably will move towards the chair for questions and answers. But bear with me for a few minutes. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you to Joe and Andy for giving me this possibility to talk to you on the topic of cities in a globalizing world. This is a topic that the bank has been doing some research on, and you may know why, partly because when you look at the role of multilateral organizations, multinational companies, you look at what's happened to the negotiations on the WTO, you realize that there's one level of dialogue at the global level with global institutions, but in the meantime, there's a very heavy dynamic at the local level, particularly driven by cities, that for the most part has not enjoyed the attention on the global scale of policy that it deserves. So I think with this book, we try to bring attention to the question of cities and the role that they play in the developing world. The other reason why we wanted to look at cities is because of the phenomenon that we are observing, that in the next 50 years, the majority of the world will be living in cities. And the majority of the growth, as you can see, will be in developing countries. And the question then is, how are these countries that are not very wealthy today going to manage such a large influx of populations and exciting opportunities of managing diversity that will be coming to their cities, and what's going to happen in that dynamic as we go forward? So the question for us was really the developing country world and the impact that urbanization has had and is going to have in the coming 50 years. You may also know that one of the reasons we pay attention to the next 50 years is because it takes time for the kind of institutions that will be needed to grow. It takes about 20 to 30 years to grow sustainable institutions. So for this future that we're seeing, we would need to be thinking about the issues today if we would be successful in the coming 50 years. Why, again, cities? I talked about for the World Bank, but for research and for policy and for the world of change, why would anyone be interested in cities? The first is cities have been the birthplace of globalization. London became the first truly world city in the 16th century when it got really connected with the rest of the world and maintained its position up to today. So it's one of the longest cities that has held a world position in influence, whether it's trade and commerce, whether it's culture, whether it's diplomacy, flows of finance, tourism, etc. So the question we wanted to ask is, given that cities have played such an important role in globalization, what role would cities in developing countries play as the world continues to globalize? The second reason is that cities, again, if you think back to Athens, but many of the other cities, have been the birthplace for democracy. And with everybody talking about the importance of democracy for development, we had the question again, what will the testing ground be for the coming years as cities grow in developing countries? Would that lead to better democracies or better managed cities, and what implications does that have? So we had three questions. First, on globalization, does it help or hurt cities? What happens during the process of globalization? The particular role of governance, and can that be measured? And also, does city performance itself have an impact on globalization and vice versa? The research was designed to test some of the well-known assumptions, but also to explore, because some of these issues had not really been looked at with data. People had theories, but there was very little empirical work, and we wanted to do a little bit more digging. So the research balances confirmatory analysis with exploratory work. You may be familiar that this is not a subject where data is abundant, so it was very difficult to collect data, and still you'll see from the conclusions that some of the conclusions cannot be completely firm because of data limitations. And this paucity of data is a key obstacle, and one of the reasons I'm excited to be here is I hope that some of the topics may excite research in this area that will generate the kind of data that will be needed to answer some of the questions. So there'll be a lot of opportunities for research that will come about from this. On the approach itself, when you read the book, you will notice that each chapter used a slightly different methodology, and the objective was to see whether the validity of the conclusions is held as you switch methodologies. So the third chapter, which looks at the role of governance and globalization, starts off with hypotheses and tests them through empirical data. Then the chapter that looks at globalization in Africa uses more exploration because it was not clear why Africa is not performing in the same way as other parts of the world. And then we wanted to understand more deeply what actually happens, and we use case studies from different parts of the world to pull out some of the key lessons. And finally, also took from game theory and political economy to do some of the theoretical analysis to test some of the hypotheses even further. And we picked five themes, which were the questions that people were asking around this. First, is there a difference as infrastructure is being provided in countries between what you would call a local infrastructure service such as water or garbage collection or a network service like roads or electricity which relies on movement from one place to another either of a service like a transportation service or access to a service such as electricity? And finally, are there global services that have a different implication in the way they are produced? For instance, cell phones. When I come to London now, I use my Washington cell phone, so it really doesn't matter to me whether London's network is working well, because you can hook up now to satellite transmission. So there's some questions around whether that has an implication on the way cities are managed, and if yes, what nature does it take? The second big question is the interface between performance of cities and good governance, asking whether there is a role there. Trying to dig in deeper on Africa, as I mentioned earlier, because of the particularities of Africa, and then to see if you can look at it as a game, seeing the way citizens respond, for instance, to investments by companies from outside the city, particularly from foreign countries, and how mayors play their role within that dynamic of their citizens and their interests versus interests from investments from outside that are also important for city performance. And then, because technology and scale have always been big issues in geography and spatial agglomerations, we also wanted to look at the role that they actually play. For the data, because it was not easy to find a single source, we collected data from a number of sources, and the largest database that we use, which has over 400 cities in it, is what we call the Kaufmann, Leoti, and Mastruzzi database, which is available to researchers for free. We put it together in order to explore some of these hypotheses. And the other data sources were collected from the UN, which had a one-year analysis of indicators of access and other indicators in some 60 countries. We used an enterprise opinion survey, which is collected every year, which has 12 governance indicators and service indicators in over 100 countries and more than 200 cities. Then there's a database developed in the UK, which we refer to as a Taylor database, which looks at the registration of companies in cities in the rest of the world, whether they are advertising, accounting, or financing companies. And that's also a large database. The globalization index at the country level we get from the A.T. Kearney database, which collects data on a number of countries. For quality of life, the Mercer index you may be familiar with, which looks at quality of life across cities. And then, of course, the CIA World Factbook, which is quite extensive in the source of knowledge on cities and countries, purchasing power parity indicators for controlling income effects were from the Hurst and Summers database. And then we also did independent internet searches to see what the cities are actually putting in terms of popularizing or advertising themselves, but also in terms of informing companies and citizens about themselves. So let me start with the first theme. What did we find in this local network versus global services? We started with infrastructure because without infrastructure, there is no basis for globalization. When you look at the evolution of cities, they all were able to evolve into world cities because they could tap into some foundational infrastructure, whether it's ports, whether it's other forms of transportation, whether it's a communication capability through diplomacy networks and so on. So infrastructure was always very key. And when you look at infrastructure, while all infrastructure has a home, it's very local in that sense. You are living next to a telephone transmission building or to an electricity plant, but the services tend many times to go beyond the boundaries of where the infrastructure is located. So the demands that used to be very local and maybe sometimes interlinked have grown tremendously, as in the example I've mentioned on telephones, but also a service like water. As a tourist or a business employee from a foreign company traveling around the world, you also care about local services if you have to spend any amount of time in a city. Crime and security being one of the most local of services you can imagine, but also now with an increased international dimension. And also because of some of the challenges since September 11th, the recent events in London in terms of the transportation network and so on, the after-facts of Katrina, people have been asking, about vulnerability and security, and saying, if I'm a local citizen and I'm only willing to pay for maintenance for what I can actually see, but I'm not willing to support maintenance for vulnerability and security, then who covers the rest? So there's some dimensions of trade-offs between today's needs and tomorrow's needs, my own needs versus the needs of society overall, and also daily use versus use for other purposes. And that's another reason why we looked at infrastructure. And particularly because the kind of institutions you need to be successful in these other forms of demand do require interface between local and global interests in a very particular way. The new institutions are those that can bridge what communities, local and national, but also regional and global entities would need, and they have to respond to these preferences over time. In the book, we explore case studies. Some of you may be familiar with the Memphis, Tennessee case, which is the first recorded case of citizens in the United States who blocked the construction of a highway because they didn't want to give up the park. And the judiciary system upheld a decision through an organized protest not to have infrastructure. So this is an example very early on of collective bargaining for a purpose of preventing something from happening. In the case of Bangladesh, it's the opposite. It's collective bargaining in order to get something to happen, but with a particular group that would lose in the process. You may be familiar with Bangladesh being very abundant in water resources, and so constructing anything anywhere usually has huge implications. But in this case, bringing different communities together to discuss and agree was able to result in a solution of a bridge that connected cities that had never communicated with each other before. So the exact opposite of the outcome in Memphis, Tennessee. And then in the news today, there's the Chad-Cameroon pipeline, very complex negotiations between extracting oil, keeping local services for citizens, but also worrying about future generations, and doing that within a very challenging governance context. So that one of the chapters in the book goes through a number of these types of case studies to bring out the issues at the local versus global level. We also explore phenomena that we believe have changed the nature of decision-making at the city level. People talk a lot about democratization. The Tennessee and the Jamuna Bridge in Bangladesh are a particular example of that nature. Technology changes have allowed decentralized provision of services, but then there's still dependence for more network services, and this causes or enables different forms of service provision to come out. As companies invest, they come with ideas, and there's a much higher diffusion of ideas now than at any time in history because of this co-production, travel, migration, trade, and so on. And so the diffusion of ideas itself is causing also preferences to shift, and so managing local issues is becoming much more complex. And we see this in the diversification of citizen preferences, where people will ask for things that they did not ask before because now they're more aware or they care more. And they're balancing efficiency with quality of life in a very interesting way. What did we do to assess these institutions? What we tried to do is to explore the interface between globalization and city performance by constructing this worldwide database that we call the KLM database, Kaufmann Leotier Mastruzzi database. And we tried to do it by measuring globalization not only at the country level, but more specifically at the city level, to see whether there are any interactions. If you are a global city in a country that's not highly globalized, are you different from being a global city in a country that's highly globalized? And what are the interactive effects? And of course, the role of governance was very key. But we had trouble because there were so many different definitions of governance that it was difficult to find one that we would stick with for hypothesis testing. We chose to use the UNESCO definition of urban governance, which looks at processes that lead communities into account, linking stakeholders, involving them, whether they are local authorities, citizens, or companies, in decision-making, and that favor either participation or negotiation amongst the actors, and favor transparency in the way decisions are made, and also favor new ideas, because that was the definition that we thought would be the most wide to test some of these hypotheses. And we also wanted to make it very concrete and say governance or globalization will matter if it can be observed. Because if you cannot observe it, you cannot also test it. Citizens are responding to something, and political leaders are also responding to something, and it's that dynamic that needs to be tested. And so with that definition, a city is at the one time a place with boundaries because of political decision-making, but it's also an outcome of an enduring performance with multiple iterations between these players. And we wanted to look at both of those dimensions in the analysis. So let me first give you a quick run through just the simple 2x2 comparisons to show you why we got excited to do more. We were comparing cities in countries measured by the level of globalization of those countries. And here we are using the A.T. Kearney Globalization Index. And when you look at things that cities don't control completely, for instance, the productivity at the city level, per capita income and employment generation, you find that for each of these indicators, cities in more globalized countries seem to have quite a wide difference in performance to those in non-globalized countries. And this data is for the non-OECD countries to really test the results for poorer rather than more advanced economies, even though the book covers both sets of countries. And these results are even more stark when you look at the global the more advanced economies. When you look at things that cities do control, for instance, through zoning, they can control residential density, they can control issues like income disparity in some ways, you also find there's a huge difference between cities in more globalized countries compared to those in less globalized countries. And the only one factor where they're doing equally badly is on households below the poverty line, where you find that they are still, even cities that are more globalized are still struggling with that particular performance variable. But I thought transportation would be of interest because what we were surprised to see is not only do cities in more globalized countries seem to perform better, but they offer much wider choice to their residents between motorized and non-motorized forms of travel. And this was a surprise because we had thought that global cities must be more congested. You always hear about congestion in London or Paris or New York, but the average shows not to be the case. And urban sprawl was one of the culprits in this particular one, because poorer cities tend to be very extensive and people travel long distances to get to work. The performance of local governments also quite interesting. What struck us was how much revenues are collected, how much is spent on an average citizen in a globalized city or a city in a globalized country compared to those that are less globalized, but also whether wages take up too little or too much of the share of the local government expenditures, which was another indicator. So this was more exploratory to just give you the different profiles. And now we go to the hypothesis testing to see what's driving some of these results. I mentioned earlier this balance between a city as a place versus a city as an endurance or a sustainable performance over time, and the role that the players play within that, the citizen, the mayor, and of course the firm. In the way we look at governance, we wanted to make sure we control for things like size and wealth, because those are known to have an impact, so we would test those, but also wanted to control for them. Because we also realized from research done by others, particularly research done on European cities in the 10 centuries past, the outcome of performance could be seen as size. Because if you are able to attract and maintain your citizens in a world where people can move, you are doing something right. So size by itself can be an outcome. So in order to remove some of these effects, we had to define the hypothesis very narrowly and test them against these particular expectations. We had a very simple framework in mind that we are looking at the quality of governance on the one hand at the city level, and the extent of globalization at the city level. Assuming that you can find cities in different quadrants, with the worst expected performance being quadrant two, where you are a poorly governed local city, where we assume that nobody would want to stay there because you are not offering any advantage, and that it is much more difficult for any city to move either vertically by improving in huge amounts governance or horizontally by attracting suddenly a lot of globalized interest, and that most naturally cities would somehow meander through the diagonal because that seems to be the easiest path. But then we tested these assumptions. This was the framework that we put together to test that. Three very simple hypotheses. The first one, governance matters. Whether you're local or global, governance is important. And that means the cities in quadrants one and four would do better than the others. The second one is that globalization matters, and that a global city has pressures that make it perform better than local cities for any given quality of governance. So quadrants three and four would be the better performing ones. And then the third one, which gives you this diagonal path, is that they actually interact, and they interact in positive ways, in a virtuous circle. To test the hypothesis, we look again, just to go over the data, a global city, which is one that has many international offices of companies. A local city has none or few, and few is one or two. Anything above two was considered to be more. And we also did some tests to check whether this makes sense in terms of the cutoff point. We measure performances by local services like water and garbage collection, network services, electricity and phone lines, but also internet and cell phone, which we consider as globalized. And we look at corruption and governance at two levels, at the country level, but also at the city level. And the indicators are in the presentation chart, so I will skip through those. When you look at local services, we're surprised to see that both global cities and local cities do perform better when they're better governed. When you look at simple indicators like access to water or sewerage, and this is repeated with all the services. But one of the factors which was interesting is the indicator on corruption. Corruption seemed to be much more debilitating for local cities than it was for global cities. And one of the questions we had is why? And we'll get to some of those results later. When you look at network services, you find that the margin of difference shrinks. Good governance gives you an advantage, but a much lower one. And again, corruption seems to be behaving strangely when you look at global cities. So the question is, why is that happening? And again, for network services, you see governance comes back as an important variable, much more than for network services. And does, but however, it's not as large a difference as when you look at water or sewerage or garbage collection, which are the local services. These are the statistical results of the differences, and where you have the red blocks, these were significant and large effects, but the stars give you the level of significance, with three stars being the highest level of significance, and the one star being the lowest we could accept, which was at 85% significance. And you see that the difference between a local and global city does appear in the question of control of corruption for local services like water, and it also appears for global services like internet access. However, the other indicators are significant, like bribery in utilities, only for the globalized services. So there seems to be an interaction between globalization and governance that shows up much more for globalized services than for local services, but corruption in particular is very important for local services. When you look at whether these issues hold when you control for income and also when you measure globalization at the country level versus the city level, and you see that all the access variables are significant and important when you look at globalization, when you look at control of corruption, but also when you look at income. So income, rich cities do better. So that gave us the indication that we needed for all our results to control for income, the wealth of cities. Comparing whether it's important to be a city in a highly globalized country or yourself to be a global city and what the marginal difference is, it it seems to be that the first effect is that globalization at the country level is very important, but there's an additional value from being a global city yourself. So cities that are globalized in globalized countries are performing much, much better than globalized cities in less globalized countries or the other way around. So it matters that you are a globalized city and not just a city in a globalized country. So now we turn to Africa, and Africa is important for us for a number of reasons. First, because it has grown, it has urbanized without economic growth, and it has relatively lower levels of globalization compared to other regions of the world. So we could actually pull out the effect of urbanization almost independently of globalization, or to really look at globalization at very low levels. And we look at the performance profiles and compare those where cities have control versus those where they don't have control, and try to see what the specific dilemma for Africa was. And the hypothesis there is that high urbanization in and of itself would not lead to high performance if it is not accompanied by interaction across cities, so globalization, in other words. Africa, as you may see, holds a very low position when you compare it on a number of indicators, whether it's waste collection, which is a very local service, or whether you look at education and health, compared to the average of cities in other parts of the world. So this is the city average, looking at regions of the world and comparing them with each other. When you look at local governments, it's not hard to see why Africa is not performing very well. Africa, an average African city, spends $10 per person per year. So with $10, you have to decide, do you give them water, electricity, schools, or hospitals? It's really quite an amazing difference when you compare the wealth of other cities. But what was very interesting is the productivity of African cities, which we were quite surprised to see. They outperform cities in Latin America, and they perform about at the same level of cities in Asia. So there's a great possibility that if Africa can link up its cities, that it could actually gain some of the benefits of globalization. When you compare countries, and these countries, there are many more in the book, but I just picked three for illustration. When you rank countries in Africa on an index of globalization, so the numbers at the top above the country name is an index of globalization, and you look at the average performance of cities within those countries, you find a country like Botswana outperforming countries like Nigeria and Senegal in city performance. And however, Botswana is not as globalized as Nigeria or Senegal if you are ranking it on the index. And we think that governance has a role to play in that. We couldn't test it explicitly except in the large sample because the number of indicators for Africa were fewer. But local government performance is a good indicator of that. And you do see that Botswana really does perform much better than the Nigerian or Senegalese cities in terms of the indicators of performance. And particularly Nigerian cities are doing very, very poorly when you look at the productivity of cities. They could do a lot more given that they're in a country that is relatively better networked than the rest of Africa. So we wanted to go into the dynamics of interaction between citizens, mayors, and firms to see if you can create a game that would pick up these political and management variables and look at them in a long-run equilibrium. We start off with a citizen, and we use the Hirschman set of choices that a citizen can use. You can either stay in your city and be captive or loyal to the mayor, whether they perform well or not. You can exit and move to another city, or you can use voice, whether you pick up the telephone and complain, whether you demonstrate, or whether you vote the mayor out during an election. And citizens can choose one of these three roles to play. The mayor, we made life very simple for the mayor, saying the mayor would either ignore what he or she is hearing or would satisfy the demands that they're hearing. And the firm is an observer who observes the game for a while and then decides to jump in. And the firm can jump in either by deciding to come and invest in that city, by deciding to influence the dynamics before investing, or to decide not to come. And that's how globalization actually happens. And then the mayor responds to the signals from the firm, and then the citizen who is observing this also responds. So the game goes in multiple iterations in this way with the players interacting with each other. So the citizen's choice is defined in this way because we assume the citizen cares about quality of life. Therefore, they'll be observing that and making choices according to the quality of life observed. The mayor can influence that quality of life, but also can influence governance. And we use corruption as the indicator because it seemed to matter for many of the tests that we conducted. And the firm influences globalization. And the firm can come and react in light of a passive citizenry, as in some of the branches of the game would show. Or the firm can be reacting in the presence of an active citizenry. And the question we test there is, does one of these choices lead to better governance or not? The results, which are in the book, are that you find there's a very low probability that you end up in a good governance, highly globalized scenario, because most of the time, if citizens don't use voice, you never get there. If citizens do use voice, you usually get there, but there are opportunities by which, through influence, the equilibrium actually does not settle on a good governance outcome. And the empirical result of that is when you look at quality of life and governance, and you find that control of corruption is positively correlated to quality of life. And so that's one of the indicators that both of these matter. But globalization is not. It's negatively correlated, but there's a lot of scatter, as you can see. Some cities do much better in managing quality of life and globalization, and others don't. So the outcome of this dynamic actually varies quite a bit. Finally, technology and scale. Here we rely on data starting with the 5,000-year-old data of 5,000 years of cities in Europe taken from Chandler. And we look at just the dynamics with the assumption that the size of a city is an outcome of performance. And the idea there was to see how have cities actually evolved over time, and has that evolution been driven by governance, because we do know it was driven by globalization. So the question was governance. And because of the last 200 years being so distinct from the last 5,000 years, we wanted to focus a little bit more on the more recent history, even though the pattern, as you can see, does seem to hold, that cities do perform well and then they fall and then they rise again and then they fall, if you were to use the indicator of the largest population observed as a performance variable. What was striking to us and unexpected was that size seemed to matter in an interesting way, that you can be a very well-governed and well-performing city if you are small, offering very high quality of life. So Curitiba in Brazil is an example. Or you can do that when you are also quite large, but that in the interim, mid-sized cities don't seem to do very well. They kind of deteriorate in their performance. So we observed an inverted U-shape. And this is something we subjected to testing to see whether it holds in other situations. And what we suspect is that we may be in this downward trend, because what you see, size does seem to go up and down if you look at it over multiple years, and it may be that's what we are observing, but this is something that needs more research to be quite conclusive as to whether mid-sized cities are destined to be badly performing. The intuitive argument we make is that if you're mid-sized and you don't do well, you will shrink. So you go back to being a small city, and then maybe you can manage. But if you're mid-sized and you do well, you should attract more investment and more residents, so you would grow. So mid-size is an unstable equilibrium, but this is the intuitive explanation. I think there's need for more research to be conclusive on that. Then, because researchers have always given importance to port cities and capital cities, a lot of people have looked at this, we wanted to see whether they perform any differently. And here we found that, yes, they do, but in different ways. Capital cities do well on what we call local services. World sports cities do better on what we call global services. And it's not hard to see the intuition behind that. If you're a port and you're competing with ports in other countries, you would have to be better performing to attract activity at your port. So being able to have services that other countries don't have would be of interest to players at the port level. World's capital cities are the seats of political power, and politicians therefore do meet the interests of their constituency, and that's why water and other local services would be better. So the intuition behind this also seems to hold. Technology was interesting. It had two directions. We found one, which is technology is an enabler of voice. Therefore, if cities do have particularly communications technology, they tend to be much better governed because voice is much higher in those cities. But that technology also can result in weakening governance. And this explains some of the results we saw on electricity, that if you can exit the system, you do it. And once you exit, you are no longer a political player in the game. Therefore, the impact on governance is minimized. Whereas if you can't exit, you have to complain or influence the leadership in order to get the services. And that's what seems to be happening there. So quickly, in terms of observations, we find that cities play an important role in shaping global decisions, that you can track this performance over long periods of time. You can look at the interface between technology and globalization and explore some of those spheres. Good performance is not per se related to city size, but good governance is obtained more often in larger cities. But that modeling these interactions is possible, and it does provide insights that people can look more into. Africa has a pattern of urbanization and globalization that points to new areas of policy and attention, but that data is an important weakness that we need to address. Conclusions on governance. We find that because of the importance of governance, reform should really focus on overall national governance first, and that financial institutions in particular should pay attention to the quality of national governance of the member countries. And in addition to national governance, local governance also matters, and that there should be support for reformist leaders because they can actually change the outcomes at the city level. They have levers that they can influence in addition to those at the national level. But managing a city today is complex, so there are skills needs. Managing a city with globalization is much more complex than without. And so countries do need to have those skills available. And so the donor community should work to help cities in particular get the kind of skills either through intercity partnerships or other forms of exchange. And new institutions that help bridge capabilities at the local level need to be identified. For Africa, we find that the process that Africa has gone through in decentralization needs to be supported because cities can add value to the development of Africa, and that needs to be looked at. But that for Africa to really advance, the coastal and larger cities would have to function beyond the country boundaries because globalization does pay off, and so if they interact with other cities, it would help. And African managers or managers of African cities need to find a way to better balance the tension between making cities attractive for investment versus meeting the needs of their growing populations and regional economies. For the researchers, we leave a few things for future research. First, on data. There are huge data gaps. Even though we've made a dent in collecting it, I think there's a lot more that needs to be done to get really long-run comparable statistics across the world. And the data we collected is available for free for anybody who wants to pursue it more deeply. Also, we think there are two themes in particular that need to be pursued. One is the characteristics of services to citizens and their implications for choice because of the importance that technology seems to play. But also whether the behavior of firms and citizens really leads to these dynamics, because we try to model it with a very simple model, but academics and other researchers can look at some of the more complex game theory and other models to see if there are spurious results that we are missing or some other dimensions. And of course, capturing the dynamics of urban governance over time would be critical, particularly to help explain what's happening in Africa. So I thank you for your attention, and I'll move over to the table for the questions and answers.
I'd like to thank you for a very stimulating presentation. I think also one that reinforces once again that one of the problems for everybody is just actually be able to get some information, and particularly some of these indicators that will actually help us to at least pose some of the questions, let alone fully answer them. But also I think it's a very very clear demonstration that you've given of a very clearly laid out research process that in terms of methodological standpoint that is quite instructive to students, I think, in terms of how to go about something like this. But it presents us with a number of interesting questions, and of course, as you say, lots of further questions as well. I wonder if we've got anybody who's got a question that you want to pose straight away, or some further information.
On the should I answer it now?
Sure.
The question you have on whether you perform better when you are in a globalized country versus you as a city being more globalized, we found that both effects matter, and that's why we control for overall country globalization. The index of overall country globalization that we measure looks at trade, looks at financial flows, looks at foreign direct investment, looks at travel and tourism, but also communication, internet and telephone communication. Whereas the indicator of globalization at the city level is actually looking at physical location of international companies at the city level. So this would be companies that actually reside in the city and have a sense of how the city is performing. And we control for the overall globalization of a country because we saw there were very strong effects that distinguish cities that are in these different types of countries. But the results show that there's an added effect of being a globalized city that is over and above the effects of being a city in a globalized country. And we could test for that because we had indicators that differentiated between the two. For some of the reasons are very intuitive. For instance, if you are in a globalized country, you have much more possibilities to be aware of opportunities for investment, for instance, that you could then market. You may have seen now cities, for instance, in the United States are competing with each other to attract the next foreign investment. And that's possible because the United States is a very globalized country. So investment in the U.S. by foreign companies is much higher than the investment of American companies outside of the United States, as you may have seen the latest statistics. So cities have begun to compete with each other for that type of investment because the overall value of the United States being a globalized country has already been tapped. And so I think this dynamic is what seems to be driving some of the results. And there may be research opportunities to test that even further to see whether it matters what kind of investment, because again, the companies we are looking at are advertising, finance, and legal companies. And it could be that manufacturing and other types of companies may have a different dynamic. But there was no data. We didn't have that kind of data to test on a large scale, and this is an area for future research. On your question on whether we looked at the interaction between the performance of local governments and the productivity of cities for Africa, the database for Africa is very, very thin. So we could look at that result for the whole world and then make extrapolations for Africa. But to test it specifically for Africa would be not statistically valid. So we didn't actually pursue that except in terms of looking at the performance of decentralized countries in Africa relative to those that are not as decentralized, with the assumption that decentralization would by definition first happen at cities before it happens in villages and smaller communities. And the result we found was that cities, decentralization to cities first seems to make an impact. So in Africa, given limited capacity, if you are to decentralize, it makes sense first to give fiscal autonomy to cities before you give fiscal autonomy to regions and districts, because then those cities can generate economic growth for the whole country. So that's what we were able to distinguish, but we couldn't go much further because of the weakness of data, and that's another area for deeper research.
Okay, thanks. Question here and then there.
I'll start with your second question first, and then answer your first question last. The results. Let me start with the analysis. The analysis we did on the differential performance of smaller towns, the district towns, rather than the larger capital cities, and so on, was done for the whole database. And I think one of the charts I showed, there are others in the book, looked at the differential performance in terms of quality of life by city size, where we found this interesting U-shape. So I think for the question you have in Africa, which we have not tested because it was hard to label, most of the data we have for Africa is for capital cities, given the paucity of data. So there are very few non-capital cities for the Africa database. We would assume that if you were to extend the result that you would find that district cities would perform better than, say, mid-sized cities, but perhaps capital and port cities would do even better, so if you follow the same shape. On conflict, we don't control for that. the only place where it would come out is if conflict results in bad governance, like bribery, state capture, because we do control for state capture. So those types of impacts we would be able to exploit. When you look at the database and all the cities we use are listed, so if you are interested in a particular city, you can drill down in the book. You will notice that for most of the countries in conflict, at most we would have one city. And if not, we may have no data at all, because it was also hard to collect data in those countries. On your question about where this work sits in the World Bank and where are we headed with urbanization in the bank, we are now considering subnational instruments for lending, but also for policy dialogue. And this work contributes to that effort. But also, when you look at capacity development, where we have realized that given the role cities are playing in globalization, we should invest a lot more in their capabilities. So the World Bank Institute, in partnership with the urban network in the World Bank, have been doing a lot of work together to develop programs that would enhance the capacity of city leaders. So we have these mayor training programs. We're supporting city-to-city networks. We are investing in quite a bit of learning across cities so that they can advance in that particular skill gap. And then, of course, city development strategies, which were defined during the last urban strategy, have become the key entry point for some of these subnational instruments that we'll be using. So I would predict that going forward you should see more attention rather than less to cities. But there are some issues that our shareholders are still sorting out in terms of the particularities of the instruments that I cannot comment right now on.
Very special contextual conditions, particularly which are rare in Africa, those contextual conditions. I wonder, looking back now, you've had 7, 8, 9 years experience in city development strategy through the Cities Alliance and so on, whether you have observations on that as an approach to cities, particularly given the fact that in the weakest states, the stranglehold government makes a city development strategy impossible, utopian. What is the hope
there?
What are you doing?
The history has taught us, I think, quite a bit. And the city I'd like to point to is Kigali, where coming out of conflict, you had a mayor who was very, very active in considering the role that the city can play for national development. And through a series of interactions locally but also internationally, the mayor has been able to define a program which positions Kigali as a technology center for the whole country, because, as you may know, the country is landlocked and therefore opportunities for export are quite limited. And the mayor was wise to see that the service sector can be a key opportunity, and you have now the Kigali Institute of Science and Technology, which is a world-class institution and is attracting students from other parts of Africa to come to a country that was in conflict not too many years ago. So we see examples of mayors in post-conflict countries taking incredible risks and having an impact on national dynamics of investment at the city level. In a country that is not a post-conflict country, but where there were instabilities in terms of crime and security and so on, is the mayor of Dar es Salaam. Again, through a process of consultation with the citizens, but also with the companies investing in the city, has been able to increase dramatically the quality of services, water, electricity, garbage collection, and therefore attract investments, including in the neighborhoods that were quite dangerous before. So we have a number of examples, particularly in Africa, that demonstrate that Maputo is the other one, also for in a post-conflict situation, that demonstrate that many times the best way to start is to start in the cities, because that's where the political power also tends to reside. Congo, we haven't done much because there are still issues to be sorted out at the national level before we can take a look at the subnational level. So I cannot comment on the particular case of Congo, but we are very hopeful, given the more recent Kigali experience, the more older Maputo experience, and the experiences of cities such as Dar es Salaam. It will still be difficult, I think, in some countries, because the cities have been seen also as taking away a lot of the power from rural areas. So Congo is a good example where that has happened. But our early results, given the successes we've seen, particularly in Kigali, do indicate that it's possible to actually have cities manage the post-conflict situation to the advantage of the city, but of the country as a whole as well.
Okay. Question here, and then.
Well, first, the research is very recent. I mean, this is the first official launch. The book just got printed 2 weeks ago. So it will take a while before we can actually see the impact it would have, both internally in the organization, but also externally. And the PRSP instrument in particular has been one where you would also note that it took a while for even infrastructure to enter into the PRSPs, because people wanted to actually clarify whether infrastructure does lead to poverty reduction or not. And that's one of the reasons why the early PRSPs did not have much mention of infrastructure at all. The research on that is, a big chunk of it has been completed, and there's more ongoing. So people are convinced now that infrastructure does play a role. And so I would say we would expect this research to have an influence on the PRSPs. The countries that have already taken urban development as a key driver are countries such as China, Brazil, and Mexico. And they are doing much better than other countries. So they have figured out the important role that cities play. And we expect over time, with the demonstration of results that will come out, that other countries would also do the same. For Africa, it's hard to tell now, because the dynamics I showed will happen in the next 50 years. But to a large extent, Africa is still a majority rural. The countries are majority rural still. What we are signaling, particularly for Africa through this research, is that if we would like to see results in Africa in the next 20, 30 years that are positive in terms of poverty reduction, we cannot ignore the cities. And there's a big strategy being developed by the Africa region of the World Bank to look particularly at African cities and what should be done differently to give this possibility of a different outcome. So I think if you look in the future years, you should see more rather than less activity. I would say subnational instruments, perhaps not so much in the poorer countries, perhaps more in the middle-income countries, but over time a growing portfolio. For the other donors, we are hoping events like this would help, that as people get to see the research and it gets publicized, it would influence the local decisions. For instance, we're hoping in the UK through DFID and other players, and so country by country, to make the research known so that donors can make intelligent choices around their own positions on the issue. But it will take time. The UN data does indeed have definitions of size in the way that you defined it. We looked at the actual population figures in plotting the results, but also in the regressions. And from the UN data, you'll find so we use the UN data, but we also triangulate it with other data sources, the CIA fact book, which is another source for population data, and also the website information for cities. So we do check, because as you may know, there's also a difference whether you're looking at a metropolitan definition or not. So we were careful around how we use size and make sure we're using the same definition for all the cities. What the UN data shows is that there are two phenomena. One is that the fastest growing cities are indeed the small towns. So there will be many more small towns becoming medium-sized cities within those 50 years. But also there will be many more megacities if you follow the projections that they are making. So it's really moving class from small to medium and from medium to very large. And those two phenomena together are the big drivers for the change in the urbanization trends. But the other important factor is the migration from rural to small town, from small town to medium city. So in addition to the what we call the vegetative growth, or the growth of the citizens who are already there, there will be these migration flows. And those flows, we also notice, go beyond countries. So cities in more advanced and better performing countries are also going to see influx of migration from other countries. So it's much more complex, and we haven't had a chance in this research to look at what those implications would be. We do know they will have issues in terms of integrating people from different cultures and different levels of skills and so on. In fact, the reason we are so keen on governance is precisely because of that. We find that better governed cities are better able to do that kind of integration. So if cities won't improve the quality of governance, they will fail on that. But we don't go into that issue within the book itself. It's a very good topic for research to uncover the differential dynamics of that change.
Okay, I think we've got time, just one. Yeah, one. Come back.
That was a hypothesis in our work, and we found that size actually does not matter for city performance, but it does matter for governance. And if you are well governed, you tend to grow. So big cities are well governed. There are very few really, really large cities that are badly governed. And I mean, there are some examples. Performance of a city like Dhaka in Bangladesh is not very high relative to other cities of the world, but relative to other cities in Bangladesh, it is high. So when you control for overall country conditions, size does matter in terms of quality of governance, and that's the main result. But size in and of itself is not important. That's why in the polynomial that we show, you actually see the size is not sustainable for a long time, and cities do break up. Montreal is breaking up. Some of the boroughs have decided to move away from the metropolitan government. The same thing is happening in Amsterdam. And in London, I think it's the other way around, right? The more centralized management of a metropolitan city. So there are different dynamics when you look at the size issue. And we think governance has something to do with it.
Okay, we're running out of time now, so I have one final question now. So,
I'd be interested about the cities here. Sorry. Because you're talking about some of the cities in Africa, I'm just thinking about, is it possible for you to talk about the city in transition economy? Because in the transition countries, I think it's much more complicated. One of the processes about the urbanization, the industrialization, but the other way is about the transition from the socialist, centralized planning system to the market system. So how can they be two different processes working together in this kind of the trend in the cities in the transition economy?
Transition economies present a particular case which actually is quite interesting to observe when you look at the dynamics between citizens, a mayor, and a firm. Because most cities in transition countries did not have a mayor. If you look at St. Petersburg today, it's not managed by a local mayor, so the autonomy of the city is rather different compared to cities in more advanced economies or even in some developing countries. And the second dynamic, which is also unusual, is the relatively low level played by the private sector, so the role of the firm. And so they present a particularly interesting set of cities to look at the dynamics, just as Africa presented for the research we did. We chose, for lack of time, to focus on Africa because it was the year of Africa and there was a lot of attention on what we need to do differently in Africa. But I would say the cities in transition countries would be of particular interest to look at the dynamics that you mentioned. We just came back from St. Petersburg and a number of researchers there are keen to look at the Russian experience and the CIS countries and explore these dynamics further. So it's a rich area for research, which I think would shed light on those dynamics.
Okay, well, just a very quick one.
This was a point of information. So would China and Vietnam, say Mongolia, be in transition country?
China, yes, would be, so would Vietnam. For the most part, we would focus on Russia and the CIS because that's where the pace of transition would have been slow enough that you can capture the effects. But China and Vietnam would also be considered transition because they did go to a market economy. And China is one of the most fascinating countries when you look at urbanization because you have a large size to, and you have a good control because it's all in one country with a very strong centralized system. So many of the factors can be tested where you can't, for instance, do it at the same scale in other countries because you have few observations. But China presents a huge research opportunity.
Okay, I think there we'll have to draw a close, and thank you very much for answering our questions, and also for giving up your time to talk about your book. And I guess that I have to ask everybody to buy the book as well. But thanks very much for your presentation. Very clear and very interesting responses to the questions. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.